President-elect Trump has chosen former Congressman Matt Gaetz to be his attorney general.
Trump has said he wants to use the Justice Department to seek retribution against his enemies, a sharp break from how past presidents have handled federal law enforcement.
For Wednesday, November 13th, it's All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Today, President Biden hosted President-elect Trump at the White House, where they talked about a peaceful transfer of power.
Politics is tough, and it's, in many cases, not a very nice world, but it is a nice world today, and I appreciate it very much.
Also this hour, a fossil from 80 million years ago sheds new light on the connection between birds and dinosaurs.
The portion of the brain that in modern birds is responsible for helping coordinate flight is not very well developed in this new fossil.
And we remember superstar Supreme Court lawyer Ted Olson.
After this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Speer. President-elect Trump is nominating Congressman Matt Gaetz of Florida to be his next attorney general. Gaetz has been a loyal ally of Trump in the House since the president-elect's first term in office. Gaetz went after former House Speaker Kevin McCarthy after Gaetz was accused of sex trafficking and illicit drug use. And McCarthy did not block a House Ethics Committee investigation. That investigation is ongoing. Gaetz has denied the allegations and noted a related FBI investigation was closed without charges. If confirmed, Gaetz would oversee the FBI. Senate Republicans have elected a new leader for when Congress convenes in January. As NPR's Barbara Sprunt explains, Republicans chose South Dakota Senator John Thune as majority leader, taking the place of Mitch McConnell, who's stepping down from leadership.
John Thune will be responsible for getting President-elect Donald Trump's agenda through the Senate with a 53-47 GOP majority. Thune is currently second in command of Republican Senate leadership and is well-liked by his peers. He was considered a front-runner leading up to the closed-door election. Some Trump allies were opposed to Thune and wanted a Trump loyalist, Florida Senator Rick Scott, to have the top leadership job. But Thune's longtime relationships with colleagues and experience won out. Barbara Sprunt, NPR News, Washington.
House Republicans, meanwhile, have nominated Speaker Mike Johnson to serve another term. Governors from mostly Democratic-led states are preparing to push back against the policies Republican President-elect Donald Trump has vowed to put in place. Governors of Illinois and Colorado saying today they'll co-chair the group. Among other things, Trump has pledged to use federal law enforcement to investigate his political foes, launch the biggest deportation in U.S. history, and purge colleges and universities of diversity programs. In California, Governor Gavin Newsom called a special session to address proposed Trump administration policies he believes would threaten his state. President Biden will meet with Chinese President Xi Jinping this weekend on the sidelines of a summit of world leaders in Peru. NPR's Asma Khalid explains the meeting comes at a critical moment in U.S.-China relations.
This will be the third and likely last time Biden will meet as president with the Chinese leader. And it comes on the heels of Donald Trump's victory in the presidential election. Trump has threatened to slap higher tariffs on China. A senior Biden administration official declined to comment on any conversations between Biden and Trump about China, but acknowledged the U.S.-China relationship is tough and complicated. The Biden White House has talked a lot about trying to responsibly manage the competition, and this weekend, Biden is expected to talk to his Chinese counterpart about military-to-military talks, fentanyl, AI, and the climate. Asma Khalid, NPR News, Lima.
Blue chips in the broader market rose slightly today. The Dow was up 47 points. The S&P rose a point. The Nasdaq fell 50 points. This is NPR. A militant group in Gaza released a video today showing one of the Israeli hostages who's been held for more than a year. It is the first hostage video to be released in several months. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reports from Tel Aviv.
The video showed 29-year-old Sasha Trifonov, a Russian-Israeli dual citizen who had a birthday earlier this week. It was unclear when the video was filmed. The video's release comes after Trifonov's girlfriend, Sapir Cohen, who had been held hostage in Gaza but was released last year, publicly urged President-elect Donald Trump last week to, quote, ensure that rescuing these hostages remains a top priority. A ceasefire deal to end the war in Gaza and bring remaining hostages home has stalled. There are 101 Israeli hostages remaining in Gaza. Around a third of them are confirmed dead, according to Israel. Meanwhile, at least 47 Palestinians were killed in Gaza by Israeli strikes in the past day, according to the Ministry of Health. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Some hope in new government data that indicates U.S. drug overdose deaths appear to be showing a sustained decline. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention saying, according to its provisional data, there were 97,000 overdose deaths during the 12-month period ending June 30th. That's down 14% from the same period a year ago. Experts are not sure why, though the overdose crisis had worsened during the COVID-19 crisis. Crude oil futures prices rebounded slightly today after hitting a two-week low on a reduced demand forecast from OPEC. Oil up 31 cents a barrel to $68.43 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Capital One, offering their premium travel card, Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's 6 minutes after 4 o'clock. Thanks for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Programming is supported in part by Pickett Agency, an official Minsure partner. It's open enrollment season, and Pickett Agency is here to support the Bemidji community with health plan enrollment and guidance. More information available by calling 218-751-1213 or by visiting PicketAgency.com. Chance of rain continues tonight, lows near 34.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. President-elect Donald Trump today announced his pick for one of the biggest jobs in his new administration, Attorney General. For that job, Trump has chosen Republican Congressman Matt Gaetz of Florida. NPR Justice correspondent Ryan Lucas joins us now with more. Hey, Ryan.
Hi there.
Hey, okay, so I saw that Trump just announced his pick for Attorney General this afternoon. How did he describe Matt Gaetz?
So Trump made this announcement on his social media platform, Truth Social, and he called Gaetz, a quote, a deeply gifted and tenacious attorney. And he said that he had distinguished himself in Congress by focusing on what Trump called a desperate needed reform at the Justice Department. Now, Trump views the job of attorney general as a top priority. It's maybe the most important job after Trump's own in the incoming administration. And Trump had a rocky relationship with his attorneys general during his first term, both Jeff Sessions and Bill Barr. He lashed out at them frequently. Sometimes he claimed for not defending him enough. In his announcement today, Trump signaled what he views as the priorities for his next attorney general. He said that few issues in America are more important than ending what he called the partisan weaponization of our justice system. He said Gaetz will work to do that and also to protect America's borders, dismantle criminal organizations, and restore what Trump called the badly shattered faith and confidence in the Justice Department.
Okay, so this is a big job for the Trump administration. Gaetz has been in Congress, you know, for several years, Ryan, but is maybe not well known to some Americans. Can you just tell us some more about him?
So he represents in Congress part of the Florida Panhandle. He's a far-right firebrand. This is not a conventional pick for attorney general. Gaetz does not have the legal pedigree of the current attorney general, Merrick Garland, who was a federal appeals court judge for decades, or of William Barr either, who served as Trump's second attorney general last term. Mm-hmm. Gaetz is a hard-charging politician. He's been a member of the House Judiciary Committee for a while now. He's been a fierce critic of the Justice Department, as well as its investigations involving Donald Trump. That includes the Russia investigation, as well as more recently, Special Counsel Jack Smith's investigations into Trump's handling of classified documents, as well as his efforts to overturn the results of the 2020 election.
And wasn't Gaetz also under federal investigation recently?
He was. He was wrapped up in a long-running federal sex trafficking investigation. He always said that he was innocent. Ultimately, prosecutors just last year, so during the Biden administration, declined to bring charges against him. Gaetz, though, is still under investigation by the House Ethics Committee. That's into allegations that he may have engaged in sexual misconduct or illicit drug use and other issues. And that probe would end if he were to resign and join the administration.
Huh. Okay. So a pretty unusual pick for a lot of reasons. What's been the reaction so far?
Well, look, Trump campaigned on the idea of seeking vengeance on those that he feels unjustly targeted him, including folks in the Justice Department. Gaetz is someone who's used that same sort of rhetoric, and this nomination would appear to be putting someone who agrees with Trump's view at the helm of the Justice Department. and the enormous power that the Justice Department wields. Gates on X said that he would be honored to serve as Attorney General. But look, his confirmation process could be rocky. Susan Collins, a Republican from Maine, she said today that she was shocked that Gates was the nominee. She said the Senate has an important role to play here in confirming nominees. And she added this.
I'm sure that there will be many, many questions raised at Mr. Gates' hearing if, in fact, the nomination goes forward.
Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, who's been a longtime member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, also said that he was surprised by Gates' nomination. Graham said that he's inclined to support Trump's nominees, but he too said that Gates is likely to face tough questions at his confirmation hearing.
That is NPR's Ryan Lucas. Thank you so much, Ryan.
Thank you.
Today, Americans got a new look at where the country stands with inflation. New data show that inflation is slowing down, but prices are still very high compared to before the pandemic. Many voters have said rising costs are a key reason they voted for Donald Trump over Kamala Harris. Here to walk us through what today's numbers mean is NPR's Laurel Wamsley. Hi, Laurel.
Hey, Ari.
To start with today's news, what did the data on consumer prices show?
Well, inflation rose slightly, up 2.6% in October from a year ago. That's a little higher than it was in September, but it's still relatively low compared to 2 years ago when inflation was peaking. And there are still pain points like housing. It's something we've seen in recent months. The data broadly measures what it costs to rent a place, and that has been rising. But not all prices rose. There was some good news, like gasoline prices have come down. And all in all, though, today's data showed that what we've known for a while is happening, that inflation is easing.
If inflation is slowing down, why are voters still feeling it so acutely and so upset about it?
Well, just because prices are no longer rising as much doesn't mean that prices are falling. Prices went up a lot during the pandemic, and people are still feeling it. In fact, reports after the election found that voters who said inflation was the most important factor in the election were almost twice as likely to support Trump than Harris. But it's not just Trump voters. Inflation affects everyone, and Harris voters are wrestling with inflation, too. Yesterday, I spoke with Alex Spangler, who voted for Harris. She's 38 and lives in a suburb of Denver called Westminster. She knows that the data shows inflation is easing, but she herself is still feeling the squeeze.
The cost of goods rose, and they've stayed there. So it still impacts our paychecks regularly. It's just, honestly put, like a big damper on our prospects for the years to come.
And those persistent high prices tend to be the essentials that people have to buy. That's something that Alex says she feels every time she goes to the grocery store.
My partner and myself both make decent wages, but with the way that inflation has increased, it's like our dollar just doesn't go as far. Simple trips to get produce from the supermarket end up being like $20 to $50 each time, even though we're not buying anything extravagant.
And that's a feeling that clearly many voters shared.
Trump campaigned on bringing inflation down. Do experts think his policies will have that effect?
Well, actually, economists say that his economic policies could make things worse. Take tariffs, for instance. Trump has threatened tariffs on a lot of goods. And given that so many things that we buy are imported, that's bound to lead to higher prices. Or take immigration. Trump has threatened to do a mass deportation of immigrants. If that happens, there will be fewer workers available to work in many jobs, and that'll lead to higher labor costs, which can lead to inflation. And the last thing is taxes. Trump has promised to cut them, which would have a few effects. One of them is that it would leave people and businesses with more money to spend, which pushes inflation up.
The Federal Reserve has, of course, been trying for years now to bring inflation down. How would they react to some of Trump's ideas?
Well, the Fed has been expected to do one more rate cut before the end of this year. And analysts say that today's inflation data means that's still more likely to happen than not. But it'll really depend on what the Fed sees in the November data, which they'll have before their next meeting. In terms of what the Fed does next year, that is anyone's guess. It'll all depend on what the Trump administration actually does and when they do it. Because the Fed had been expected to make more interest cuts throughout next year. But if Trump's moves do make the economy hotter, then the Fed might well decide not to make those cuts or to delay them for a little bit.
That's NPR's Laurel Wamsley. Thank you.
You're welcome, Ari.
The birds of today descended from the dinosaurs of yore. But researchers have known relatively little about the bird's brain and how it took shape over millions of years. Science reporter Ari Daniel describes a new fossil that sheds light on that mystery.
Bird brain should be a complement Daniel Field is a vertebrate biologist at the University of Cambridge.
Birds are one of the most intelligent groups of living vertebrate animals. They really rival mammals in terms of their relative brain size and the complexity of their behaviors.
But it's been hard to piece together how bird brains evolved. First, most of the fossil evidence dates back to tens of millions of years before the end of the Cretaceous, when dinosaurs went extinct and birds really diversified. And those fossils of feathered dinosaurs that have turned up often have a key problem, says paleontologist Luis Chiappe with the Natural History Museum of Los Angeles County.
They're beautiful, but they're all like roadkill. They're all flattened. And there are aspects that you're never going to be able to recover from those fossils.
Such as the shape and 3D structure of the brain. Then in 2016, a Brazilian paleontologist discovered a remarkably well-preserved fossil in Sao Paulo state. It came from a prehistoric bird that fills in a crucial gap. The animal in question lived 80 million years ago, so before the dinosaur mass extinction event.
Relatively small bird, something the size of between a pigeon and a starling. It would have been an active flyer, you know, fully feathered.
And its skull, he says,
is very modern looking, strikingly modern looking.
The researchers were able to CT scan this intact, delicate skull, allowing them to digitally reconstruct the animal's brain. Some parts were more dinosaur-like, says Daniel Field.
For instance, the portion of the brain that in modern birds is responsible for helping coordinate flight, called the cerebellum, is not very well developed in this new fossil.
On the other hand, the cerebrum, the part of the brain associated with higher level cognition, was pretty big, much larger than that of the bird-like dinosaurs that came before, and almost as large as modern birds.
It tells us these sorts of transitional birds, they may well have been very clever and indeed much more clever than anything that had previously come before.
Which would have likely helped these ancient birds find food or mates, and more complex cognition could have supported a more complex social structure. The research is published in the journal Nature. For NPR News, I'm Ari Daniel.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thanks for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. It's 4:18. In a moment, our daily dose of phenology with John Latimer. We receive support from the Lake Country Journal, a local lifestyle magazine sharing stories about places to go, things to do, and people to know in Lake Country. More at lakecountryjournal.com. Chance of rain continues overnight, lows near 34, mostly cloudy tomorrow, highs in the mid-40s. Sunny on Friday with highs 46 to 50.
On today's date, November 13th, in the year 2006, I get a report from a friend who lives on the Sherry's Arm portion of Pakegama Lake of a single common loon hanging out in the waters there. Loons typically migrate a little bit earlier than this, and the adults much earlier than the juveniles. The adults gather on area lakes and fly over to Lake Michigan and spend the couple of weeks, maybe 3 weeks in Lake Michigan, and then turn and head south and end up in the Gulf of Mexico after a two-day journey. But the juveniles, and this may have been a juvenile because they are among the last to leave the area, the juveniles take a rather circuitous route to the Gulf of Mexico, one that was radio tagged by a crew that I was part of, spent most of its migration wandering back and forth across the Mississippi River, first Illinois and then Missouri and then back into Kentucky and then across to Louisiana, but finally ending up in the Gulf of Mexico. So these late leaving loons are often juveniles, and given the fact that they have no instructions and no clear pattern, they oftentimes are a bit trepidatious about the trip.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Insperity, providing HR services and technology from payroll, benefits and HR compliance to talent development. Learn more at Insperity.com/HR Matters. And from the NPR Wine Club, bringing people wines inspired by NPR shows. Whether purchasing a few bottles or joining the club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Last night, Donald Trump announced the creation of the Department of Governmental Efficiency, or DOGE. He named two of his most prominent allies from the business world as the heads of this department: Elon Musk, the CEO of SpaceX and Tesla, and Vivek Ramaswamy, an entrepreneur who ran against Trump for the Republican nomination earlier this year. DOGE is getting a lot of attention, but a lot about it is unclear. Here to tell us what we do know is NPR political correspondent Danielle Kurtzleben. Hey, Danielle.
Hey, Elsa.
All right, let's do this. What do we know so far about DOGE?
We know very little, but we can glean some information from the statement Trump put out about it. For example, it is not clear if Trump envisioned DOGE as an official governmental department, and creating that would require an act of Congress.
Right.
But what we do know is that Trump said Musk and Ramaswamy would be providing guidance from, as he put it, outside of government. So presumably, question mark, they are not intended to be government officials.
Huh.
But that raises more questions, because if this is an outside commission somehow, how is it funded?
Right.
If it's taxpayer, how does that work? And how big is it? If it's somehow, maybe, funded from outside of government, wouldn't there be conflicts of interest? But then there's one more important point here, which is that whatever cuts DOGE ends up recommending, Musk and Ramaswamy can't cut anything. Congress has the budget power.
Exactly. Okay, so do we know anything about what Musk and Ramaswamy's priorities might be?
In short, cutting, but that's about it. Ramaswamy said during his primary campaign for president that he wanted to cut the federal workforce by 75%.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Musk said during Trump's October campaign rally at Madison Square Garden, he wants to cut government spending by $2 trillion. Now, both of those would be massive if they somehow happened. $2 trillion is around one-third of total government spending per year. That would be very hard to cut without slashing the biggest government spending programs like Medicare and Social Security, which Trump has said he would not cut. So it's unclear how that would work. Likewise, cutting three quarters of the federal workforce is a lot. And keep in mind, there are federal workers all over the country, including in red states. So it's not as if GOP members of Congress would be gung-ho about cutting a bunch of jobs. But here's something important. We don't know what the top priority of this commission is. The statement about it talks a lot about cutting the federal workforce, but also talks about spending. Those two are not equivalent. The federal workforce is such a small part of government spending. As of 2022, that workforce received around $270 billion in compensation. Government spending total is $6.5 trillion. So it's hard to put a dent in that by cutting workers.
Yeah, big difference between those two numbers you just cited. Okay, so how does this new department or non-department, I don't know what to call this yet, play into what we know about Trump's other ambitions for his second term?
I mean, in brief, it aligns with something he did at the end of his last term, which is called Schedule F. The basic idea is to recategorize federal workers, replace people in career positions with political appointees. Biden rescinded that. But he could do that again, cutting a lot of workers. But the big question to me is Trump's fiscal plans. This could save some money, but he wants a bunch of tax cuts.
Exactly.
And so deficits could go up as they did the last time he was president.
That is NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben. Thank you, Danielle.
Thank you.
President-elect Trump implemented a policy in his last term that is still unresolved today, and it could foreshadow what might come next. We're talking about family separation. Years after that operation ended, more than 1,000 kids taken from their parents at the border still have not been reunited with their families. And the man Trump has named his next border czar, Tom Homan, has been described as the architect of family separation. NBC News correspondent Jacob Soboroff is author of the book and executive producer of the documentary Separated. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Thanks so much.
So the Department of Homeland Security separated more than 5,500 children from their families at the border. Why are there still more than 1,000 kids who were effectively made orphans by the federal government?
As many as 1,360, according to the last status report from the Department of Homeland Security, because, wow, Ari, the policy was so, and I think it's a generous description, haphazardly implemented and deliberately cruel. Even some of the officials today will tell you that the idea was to hurt children and families, to scare other people away from coming to this country. And part of that was the systems weren't in place to track and reunite the families once they ultimately separated them. We're still dealing with the consequences of that today.
And can you tell us anything about who those 1,300 or so kids are, who their parents are?
Kids from all over the world, actually. Many of them, as a matter of fact, are here in the United States, potentially living with other family members, and their parents were deported at the height of the policy. And even though there's an effort underway by the Biden administration and many members of civil society to literally go door-to-door in Central America and locate these parents, the Republican-appointed, George W. Bush-appointed judge who stopped this policy said it was one of the most shameful chapters in the history of our country.
What impact do the separations have on the kids who were reunited with their parents?
Profound. In a way that you will never be able to describe this. And even though we made a film, what I hope is that one day there'll be a Shoah-like project where all 5,500 children will be able to speak out and tell their own story in a way that we don't have to wait another 150 years like we did for the U.S. government to apologize for Native American boarding schools, or a generation for the sites of Japanese internment camps to become national historic monuments.
In an interview with Univision just last year, Donald Trump defended the policy, saying it had the intended impact of deterrence.
We did family separation. A lot of people didn't come. It stopped people from coming by the hundreds of thousands, because when they hear family separation, they say, well, we better not go, and they didn't go.
Is that true? Was it an effective deterrent?
No, and people do not come to the United States because it's a walk in the park, like Donald Trump said. They make the most dangerous journey humans can make on planet Earth because of desperate circumstances. But you don't leave your home and take that journey for no reason. And you certainly wouldn't do it in the face of deterrence-based policies that are intended to harm you if you didn't feel like you had to.
So let's talk about what the next 4 years might bring. Trump's new border czar, Tom Homan, has said he, in the next term, would try to deport families together as one unit. Is that even possible, considering that more than 10.5 million American citizens live in mixed-status families?
Yeah, what he's talking about is American citizens leaving the United States with their undocumented family members. Maybe as many as 20 million people live in a household with an undocumented family member living under the same roof. Deporting members of those households results in family separation, and the idea that a U.S. government official would say they can all just leave together, he's saying we'll kick American citizens out of the country too, Homan is.
To the specific question of if a mother with a child shows up at the U.S.-Mexico border, is that child going to be taken away from the mother, potentially never to be reunited again? Can you say with confidence that that, at least, is a thing of the past?
There was a settlement agreement that was entered between the ACLU and the Biden Justice Department that banned the practice of family separation for 8 years under this what's known as a consent decree. But there's nothing stopping this incoming Trump administration from attempting to get around that consent decree, just like they got around, ultimately what the judge says was the U.S. Constitution, by implementing the family separation policy in the first place. There is nothing stopping, because Congress hasn't passed a law banning the practice outright, any administration from implementing a family separation policy again.
NBC News correspondent Jacob Soboroff is executive producer of the documentary Separated, which is in theaters now, and it's based on his book of the same name. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Ari.
This is NPR News.
President-elect Trump has promised to cut requirements and incentives for car companies making electric vehicles. What happens to automakers that have already made big bets on EVs?
Some companies might not make it across the line if some of these incentives and regulations change to the degree that we're hearing that they might.
We'll look at what Trump's stance on electric vehicles could mean for the auto industry's plans tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Morning Edition starts at 5 a.m. tomorrow on KAXC, and tune in for the Thursday morning show with Heidi Holton and Malachi Coons. We'll talk with the early bird fishing guide, Jeff Sundin, at 6:20. I'm Jennifer Barr. In a moment, National Native News. We receive support from L&M Fleet Supply, carrying a variety of products for your next outdoor adventure with 13 locations across the Northland. More at lmsupply.com. And we thank the Minnesota Historical Society, presenting holiday sleigh rides at the Forest History Center in Grand Rapids, featuring a horse-drawn sleigh ride through the Northwoods to make holiday memories in the great outdoors. Private group reservations available upon request. More at mnhs.info/foresthol. Day. Cloudy overnight, chance of rain with lows near 34 and mostly cloudy tomorrow, highs in the mid-40s. For Friday, mostly sunny, highs 46 to 50.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. As Republicans and Democrats battle it out for control of the U.S. House, Alaska's lone congressional seat appears to be closer to being flipped. The seat is held by Democrat Mary Peltola, the first Alaska Native to be elected to Congress. KNBA's Rhonda McBride has the latest numbers.
Since election night, Mary Peltola has trailed her Republican challenger, Nick Begich III, by about 10,000 votes. After the Alaska Division of Elections added more than 38,000 votes to the totals late Tuesday night, Peltola cut into her opponent's lead by a few hundred votes, but the gap between the two candidates remains about the same. So far, Begich has 49.1% of the vote, not enough to avoid triggering Alaska's ranked choice voting system on November 20th. If Begich cannot surpass a threshold of 50% of the vote, the second choice votes for the other two candidates in the race will be divided between Begich and Peltola, who will have to get a lion's share of those votes to pull out ahead. The next election update comes this Friday. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
People on the Wind River Reservation say President Joe Biden's recent apology for the federal Indian boarding school system needs follow-up. The school sought to assimilate Native children and separate them from their languages and cultures. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman has more.
In recent years, both the Eastern Shoshone and Northern Arapaho tribes have brought home remains of children who died at the Carlisle boarding school. The trauma of the boarding school system still impacts those communities today.
I hope they prove it. It's good for Biden to offer an apology, but that isn't enough.
I think the apology needs to go deeper than just the boarding school issue. It needs to deal with physical genocide, extermination, decimation of the buffalo.
Increase funding for tribal nations to be able to regain everything that was lost because of the boarding school policy.
That was Northern Arapaho member Cherokee Brown, former Eastern Shoshone Business Council Chairman John St. Clair, and Northern Arapaho Business Councilwoman Karen Returns to War. I'm Hannah Haberman.
Federal officials announced a new round of funding to help tribes access clean drinking water. As Alex Hager reports for the Mountain West News Bureau, that includes nearly $35 million for tribes in Arizona, Colorado, Nevada, New Mexico, and Wyoming.
Across the country, nearly half of all tribal homes do not have access to reliable, clean drinking water. This money, which comes from the Inflation Reduction Act, is part of a federal effort to change that. The Ute Mountain Ute tribe in Colorado and the San Carlos Apache tribe in Arizona are among those getting money to plan, build, and maintain pipelines and water treatment plants. The Biden administration says this pool of money will help it stay on track with a goal to give 40% of its climate spending to marginalized communities. This comes as tribes in the Southwest are asking for a bigger say in talks about how to use the Colorado River. They've been largely excluded from negotiations about the river since the earliest days of its management. I'm Alex Hager.
The Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma and Prime Video have teamed up to bring the Cherokee language to viewers through dub and subtitles on select titles in Prime Video's library. It's part of the tribe's efforts to preserve the Cherokee language. The first production was Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power. The episode premiered during a recent special screening in Tahlequah. All season one episodes of the series are being translated and expected to be available in Cherokee by the spring of 2025. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by Drummond Woodsum, a full-service law firm whose nationally recognized tribal nations practice provides services to tribal nations and their enterprises and to companies that do business with tribes across the country. More at dwmlaw.com.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates, all from one platform. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington. On the campaign trail, President Biden said Donald Trump was a threat to democracy, and Trump questioned Biden's mental fitness. But today, the two presidents sat side by side in the Oval Office. NPR's Tamara Keith joins us from the White House. Hey, Tam.
Hi.
What were they doing today?
Well, this is a traditional, even ceremonial meeting. It lasted nearly 2 hours. I will say the press was only in the room for the very beginning, where there was a handshake and a few words.
Welcome.
Thank you very much. And thank you very much. And politics is tough, and it's in many cases not a very nice world, but it is a nice world today, and I appreciate it very much. A transition that's so smooth, it'll be as smooth as it can get.
That was as close as Trump got to publicly acknowledging their long-standing tension.
Any idea what they talked about for the couple hours that the press was not in the room?
They were talking about the transition. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre said it was substantive and that Trump was gracious. She said he brought a list of questions to go over and that their chiefs of staff were in the room. She said Biden brought up legislation that needs to be taken up by Congress before Trump takes office. That includes government funding and disaster aid. We have no idea how Trump reacted to any of this. And regardless of whether it was as cordial as the White House says it was, Trump is coming into office having run on completely reversing as much of what Biden has done as possible.
Sounds like there's some cognitive dissonance there.
There is. There is so much history. In 2020, Biden ran a campaign arguing that Trump was a unique threat to democracy. Biden won, and then Trump refused to accept the outcome, like to this day. When the two men met on the debate stage earlier this year, they didn't shake hands. And Biden bombed that debate so badly, it essentially ended his political career. Right up until the election, Biden was sounding the alarm about the dangers of Trump returning to office. And then today, the two presidents were sitting together in the Oval Office like everything was normal.
Well, given that history you just laid out, why did the White House extend this olive branch?
Biden was trying to model democratic norms. You know, elections have consequences, and accepting the result and working to help your successor is a democratic norm. His team is talking about a smooth transfer of power so much it is like they are trying to will it into existence.
Give us an update on how the transition's going.
The Trump transition hasn't signed key documents that would actually give them access to agency information and other resources to make the transition smooth. And that is a break from precedent. But Trump is moving at a rapid clip, announcing personnel picks for his new administration. And some of them, I think, are what we could safely call shock nominations. There was Fox and Friends host Pete Hegseth for defense secretary. Then there's former Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard for Director of National Intelligence, and Florida Congressman Matt Gaetz for Attorney General. We're going to be talking about these picks for weeks to come. They all lack relevant management experience, but they have the most important qualification of all, which is loyalty to Trump and a willingness to execute on his vision. And all of this is in line with Trump's lessons learned from the first time in office, when he surrounded himself with people who were generally very well qualified for their jobs, but who ultimately stood in the way of the norms-busting things that Trump was trying to do. Now the question is, can he get these people confirmed by the Senate? And going back to norms and traditions, there is generally a deference to the president's choices, especially from those in his own party, and Republicans will control the Senate come January.
That's NPR senior White House correspondent Tamara Keith. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, as we heard, President-elect Donald Trump has announced that he will nominate Pete Hegseth, a Fox News host and Army veteran, to be his next Secretary of Defense. Now, the choice of Hegseth, who's 44, stunned many people on Capitol Hill, in the Pentagon, and in the retired ranks. They expected a pick to be one of several lawmakers. Let's hear more from NPR Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman now. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Elsa.
Okay, you have covered the Pentagon for a quarter century, am I right? Can you explain why this choice of Hegseth is such a surprise?
Well, first of all, his background is a TV commentator. Most defense secretaries have more substantial records in politics, the military, or industry. Now, Hegseth did serve in the National Guard, deployed to Guantanamo Bay, Iraq, Afghanistan, but a very thin resume. I went over the biographies also of defense secretaries and secretaries of war going back to the beginning of the Republic, and I can say without a doubt he has the least experience.
Huh.
And not well known, one Capitol Hill aide I spoke with said, I had to Google his name. A retired general reacted with a word I cannot use on the air.
Okay, so why do you think Trump picked Hegseth for this job?
Well, it seems loyalty. Hegseth is a staunch supporter of Donald Trump, who said in a statement that, quote, Pete is tough, smart, and a true believer in America first. Our military will be great again, and America will never back down. Now, Trump says our military will be great again. That means he sees a problem now. Hegseth and other conservatives have long complained the military cares more about diversity and equity than meritocracy and preparing for war. Now, Hegseth did say recently that integrating the military back in 1948 was a huge success because black and Hispanic men can perform like white guys. But he went on to say that the military has turned into some kind of a woke social experiment and it's hurt the military. Here he is recently on the Sean Ryan show.
You saw the trans stuff come at the end of the Obama administration. You saw the women in combat come at the end of the Obama administration. It's because they looked around at the bureaucracies that they controlled in Washington and the one that was that they didn't control. The Obama spent a disproportionate amount of time focusing on the Pentagon.
Well, to be fair, this has long been a criticism in conservative circles, right?
That is right. It's been that way for years. And it's important to note that there has been resistance within the military. The Marine Corps was against gays and lesbians serving openly and also was opposed to women serving in ground combat. But they accepted it, and both groups are present in very small numbers. Just over 4% of Marines identify as gay or bisexual, and small numbers of women, maybe a handful each year, make it through the tough Marine Infantry Officer Course and Army Green Berets. Again, just a handful are women. So there's really no widespread sense that these changes have disrupted the military. And of course, the ground wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are over, but there are always complaints, especially among the old guard.
All right. Well, do we have any sense of how Pete Hegseth would make changes at the Pentagon?
Well, the sense is he will, of course, end any diversity programs and maybe retire or replace senior officers he sees as woke or who did not get the promotion through what he sees as merit alone. He has said before that the current Joint Chiefs Chairman, General C.Q. Brown, has pursued radical positions from left-wing politicians. So you could see him replaced as well as other senior officers. But as far as running the Pentagon, he'll need a strong deputy and an experienced staff because he's never really run a big organization. And I think the center of gravity will be at the White House like it is now, with incoming National Security Advisor Mike Waltz playing a central role. Elsa, he has a lot of experience as a congressman, Green Beret, and former Pentagon official.
That is NPR's Tom Bowman. Thank you so much, Tom.
You're welcome.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Fire officials say they've stopped the spread of a deadly wildfire burning in rugged terrain on the New York-New Jersey border. But they also say growing drought worsened by climate change is sparking wildfires and water shortages across much of the northeastern U.S. NPR's Brian Mann reports.
Over the last 24 hours, officials say fire lines surrounding the Jennings Creek blaze northwest of New York City held despite dry conditions and 35-mile-an-hour winds. More than 300 firefighters, including National Guard crews and helicopters, are battling the 5,000-acre wildfire in steep hillsides and dense forests. Speaking today, New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy praised fire crews, but he described his entire state as a powder keg.
And the numbers are frankly staggering. Since early October, the New Jersey Forest Fire Service has responded to 537 fires.
That's a huge increase from just a few dozen blazes last autumn, with Massachusetts and New York also seeing a surge in brush and wildfires. Samantha Borisoff is a climatologist with the Northeast Regional Climate Center at Cornell University. She says unprecedented drought conditions are hitting much of the East.
It's just unfortunately a recipe for wildfires to start to burn deeper, to burn longer, be harder to put out.
Borisoff pointed to the city of Philadelphia, which saw no rain at all in October.
It was the first time that they've ever had a month back, I believe, to 1871, where they've not had measurable precipitation. So we're talking just, you know, intensely dry.
These blazes in the East, often started by campfires, the burning of yard waste and other human activity, are smaller than the massive wildfires common in the western U.S. But experts say they appear to be growing more common and more intense, often burning near densely populated areas, threatening homes and triggering dangerous air quality. Greg McLaughlin, who heads New Jersey's Office of Lands and Forests, says conditions are so dry this year, wildfires are continuing to burn underground long after they appear extinguished. He described one blaze that's been burning since July.
This fire continues to smolder, smoke, and burn. And when the opportunity comes for the fire to find an air pocket or perhaps a dead tree, it comes back above ground again.
Many states across the Northeast have banned outdoor burning while this drought continues. Speaking today, New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy also called for voluntary water conservation and said if the forecast for more dry weather holds, a full-scale emergency could be declared soon.
This drought could grow even more severe, which may eventually require mandatory water restrictions.
Murphy also said states in the East will need more resources to prepare for natural disasters like these wildfires because of climate change.
The reality is the drought that we're currently experiencing is just one example of how a changing climate is impacting our state today. Not far off into the future, but right now, in the here and now.
The Jennings Creek fire claimed one life over the weekend. Dariel Vasquez was an 18-year-old crewman with the New York State Parks Department. He was cutting a defensive fire line when struck by a falling tree. Randy Simon is New York State Park Commissioner.
Truly, our hearts are out to his family. And our parks peer counseling services were also in the car within hours to meet with the teams who are still dealing with this tragedy themselves.
Officials say dozens of fire departments around the East are sending crews and equipment to help as this unprecedented wildfire season drags on into winter. Brian Mann, NPR News, New York.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's 4:48. Thanks for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 5:30, the Up North Report, local news from our region. 6 o'clock, As It Happens, news from a Canadian perspective with the CBC. And at 7 o'clock this evening, Roger Radio, our Volunteer of the Year, your host for On the River, bringing you a great mix of music. Support comes from Timberlake Lodge in Grand Rapids, offering an endless soup and salad bar for lunch and burgers and hand-cut steaks for dinner, online at timberlakelodgehotel.com. Cloudy overnight, chance of rain continuing, lows near 34, mostly cloudy tomorrow, highs near 45, lows tomorrow night in the mid-30s, and for Friday, mostly sunny, highs 46 to 50. Do you love KAXE? Do you work in a business in northern Minnesota? You can support the station by becoming a business sponsor. Find out more. Email sponsors@kaxe.org or you can call 218-326-1234 and ask for Peggy, Jen, or Chris. Watermark Art Center hosts their final Poetry Slam of the year Thursday, November 21st at Fozzie's Smoke and Barbecue in Bemidji. Live music begins at 6 p.m., poetry performances at 7. Poets should prepare 3 original poems that have not been previously performed, each under 3 minutes reading time. Find more information and register at watermarkartcenter.org. November is National Family Caregivers Month, recognizing that caregiving can be challenging. You can give family caregivers a break by becoming a respite volunteer through Lutheran Social Services. Volunteers visit older adults at their home each week. No prior experience necessary and training is provided. Visit lss.org/caregiver for more information. Thanks for choosing KAXE this afternoon. There's more ahead from All Things Considered.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Theodore Olson, a giant in the legal profession, died just after midnight this morning after suffering a massive stroke. He argued 65 cases before the Supreme Court. NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg has this remembrance.
Ted Olson didn't break into the public consciousness until 2000, when he argued and won Bush v. Gore, the Supreme Court case that delivered the presidency to George W. Bush. His subsequent nomination to be Solicitor General of the United States was fiercely opposed by Democrats, who saw him as too political. But over the following 3 years, he proved time and again that he was a lawyer first and a true believer second. A longtime opponent of attempts to regulate campaign money, he nonetheless argued and won the 2003 Supreme Court case upholding a major campaign finance law. As he once told me, it wasn't even close. Congress passed the law. My duty was to defend it, even if I disagreed with the policy. But 6 years later, as a private lawyer, he persuaded the court to eviscerate much of the same campaign statute. Olson's tenure as Solicitor General was marked by personal tragedy. On 9/11, his wife Barbara, herself a conservative firebrand, was on the hijacked plane that went down at the Pentagon. As he recounted to NPR in 2016,
she called me from the airplane. Somehow she got through. I realized that if she was on the phone, she was alive. But when I spoke with her, she told me that her plane had been hijacked. We talked for a minute or two, and then the line went dead.
Olson went on to strongly defend many of the Bush administration's anti-terrorism policies, but on more than one occasion warned administration officials, including the president himself, that some of those policies would not pass constitutional muster at the Supreme Court. His warnings proved prophetic in at least a couple of cases. Most of Olson's legal life, however, was as a private lawyer, where, among other things, he championed the cause of corporations large and small. He was a rock star at the Conservative Federalist Society, but he was also unpredictable. He championed the cause of the so-called Dreamers, and he teared up in 2010 when I asked him why, as a conservative, he was leading the charge on gay marriage.
If you were a conservative, how could you be against a relationship in which people who love one another want to publicly state their vows and engage in a household in which they are committed to one another and they become part of the community and accepted like other people?
He was also a reliable supporter of the rights of reporters. That's how I first met him. He was an assistant attorney general in the Reagan administration, and I was a young and admittedly ambitious reporter. My problem was my beat included the Justice Department, and I was being frozen out by the press office. So I was frantically looking for a solution when someone suggested I get to know Ted. So I invited him to lunch and pleaded my case. He promptly took my complaint to the Attorney General, who responded, "This is not the way we do business." That message was conveyed, and the deep freeze melted. In political Washington, he was seen by the right and left as a man of principle, a conservative who fought the administrative state before it was even called that, a staunch opponent of affirmative action in college admissions, but who quietly and without fanfare also declined to represent Donald Trump. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
There are art museums and art galleries, and then there are art houses, literally abandoned homes that artists have transformed into works of art. There are a handful of these around the world, and four are in Pittsburgh. NPR's Jennifer Venasco went to see one that opened this fall.
From the outside, the four Troy Hill art houses look like any other buildings in the neighborhood. There's no signs, no gift shop.
Hello.
Mark
Dion is the artist who is commissioned to turn this formerly derelict house into a series of installations. Dion's work is in the Tate in London, the Museum of Modern Art in New York. He's a big deal.
Okay, we're in front of a house that we're calling Mrs. Christopher's house.
There actually was a Mrs. Christopher, and outside her house looks pretty boring. It has white vinyl siding. It's a bit nondescript. Then we go inside. And on the first floor, we see what could be a diorama in a museum. It's Christmas Eve, 1961. There's an aluminum Christmas tree, also magazines, furniture, felt stockings around the hearth, and of course, a pile of presents. Diane says the room is anticipating one moment.
When the kids will rush down from their bedrooms and find what Santa has left them.
The diorama, he says, captures an instant in time.
I think every house has a moment where it's at its apex. And every city has a moment where it's at its apex. And so this is this kind of optimistic moment for blue-collar family, knowing that things are on the rise, that their
status is on the rise. Diane is perhaps best known as a conceptual artist who thinks about how we collect and display objects, what it says about us. And he says he created this house to be a time machine.
You're transported to all kinds of different locations and different times.
We move from the 60s upstairs to a medieval-looking door.
And what you see locked behind this door is a very large, very fat brown bear.
You just feel like there's a story here, because looking at the bear, it looks like there's like a cut-off chain. Like maybe the bear is about to escape. Good luck, bear.
Every room has a story. But this is just one of the four Troy Hill art houses. Each are surprising in their own way. In one, you crawl through a fireplace to find a secret room with a kind of putting green. In another family home, there's a full-sized lighthouse crammed in there with a working light. Evan Mirapol is behind the project. He's an art collector, and when he moved to Pittsburgh and realized there were all these abandoned houses, he decided to turn them into art.
People ask me, how do I choose the different artists for the pieces? I don't have any strict criteria.
Well, there's one thing.
I have a high confidence that an artist can create a work that is layered and complex enough to reward multiple visits.
Like Mrs. Christopher's house. I'm back with artist Mark Dion, and we're about to enter the final room.
So this is the door to the attic of the building.
Dion pulls over a rolling ladder because there's one last surprise. About 500 boxes of all shapes and sizes stacked on shelves to the ceiling.
And all of those boxes hold wonderful things. You don't know what you're going to encounter when you open a box. It's, you know, they're very strange things.
What are those?
That is, I think these are industrial fasteners.
One of them's filled with just glass marbles. I mean, this is really...
fancy boxes, simple boxes, lots of tin boxes. There's lots of objects that are evocative of the past, evocative of one's childhood.
In other words, visitors can time travel. The Troy Hill Art Houses are free to the public. You just need to get to Pittsburgh. Jennifer Venasco, NPR News, Pittsburgh.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits at progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents. From the Cy Sims Foundation, partnering with organizations and people since 1985, working for a better and more just future for all. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Nervive. Nervive Nerve Relief is designed to reduce occasional nerve aches, weakness, and discomfort in hands or feet due to aging. Learn more at nervivehealth.com. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
It's a minute before 5 o'clock. Thanks for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We're telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Find more at KAXE.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. Stay tuned for another hour of All Things Considered, including the Up North Report, local news from our region at 5:30. At 6 o'clock, as it happens, news from a Canadian perspective. We receive support from FixCon Roofing, professionally trained roofers committed to using local building suppliers for your custom roofing needs in northern Minnesota. More at FIKSCON.com. Our weather for tonight, cloudy, chance of rain, lows near 34.